I think advised that the UIF and the compensation fund have already been given sharing rights, so we shouldn't have a delay and we're good to go. Colleagues, last week the minister indicated that there is a cabinet lekgotla, and up until yesterday we were trying to maneuver that he be present, but his dilemma is that he is currently a minister on one hand and is acting in another department as well. And so he has got back-to-back presentations at that lekgotla. A postponement was not going to be possible for us because we had already done quite a number of maneuvers. In the event that he can come through, he will pull through. But presentations have been sent, and the
recording in progress.
And officials from both the compensation fund and the UIF are present. So I'm suggesting then, colleagues, that we proceed in that fashion. I am told there are two
recording stopped.
Why are we stopping recording? All right, I suppose that will be sorted out. All right. So colleagues, what we'll do is we've got two apologies on our side.
Recording in progress.
All right. Are we good to go, Siraj? All right. All right. Compensation Fund, UIF, welcome, and to all our stakeholders. So I suggest, colleagues, then that we go to the presentations. We'll start with the Compensation Fund. And then after that, when we're done engaging with that, we will take the UIF presentation. So colleagues, good morning and welcome. Just one, the reminder that our reports are coming in on Thursday. The South African Post Office and the ESCOM report. I know there were some changes to the program that the programming committee effected after we had met. We remain on the program of the House this week, so that we've been moved further down on that report. So we are the last reports on Thursday. So they are still there. The changes that have been effected don't affect us. So we remain on the program. What we will be advised on is whether both reports will be taken simultaneously or they will be taken individually. The whippery will come back to us on that one. So just thought, so as soon as we know, we'll let you know as to how those will be debated on Thursday. Right, so colleagues, on that note, thank you very much for your attendance this morning. Let us therefore go to the Compensation Fund. Compensation Fund, over to you.
Good morning, Chair, and good morning to the honorable members. My name is Vuyo Mafata, the Compensation Commissioner, so I'll take the committee through the presentation. So the purpose of the...
I know that your presentation is very extensive. If I'm not mistaken, it's almost some 54, 55 slides or so. If you could cover the salient points with a more particular sharp focus on those as opposed to going through each one. So like the important issues. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you, Chair. I will certainly do that, Chair. So the purpose of this is just to give an update to the committee on to the standing committee on the progress that we've made with regards to corrective measures that have been implemented in the fund since our last engagement with the committee. Chair, this is just the content. I'll just keep the background of the that is known about the fund in terms of its vision and mission statements and strategic focus over the last 3 years and the next 2 years. Chair, in summary, the commitments that had been made by the minister in the last appearance and the DG was that one would look at the issue of skills and bringing in capacity in the office of the CFO to make sure that we intensify the work that we had started with regards to improvement of controls and audit outcomes, and also developing an action plan that is going to help us to get to this improved outcome. And there had been also commitments made by the minister that the whole architecture of the compensation fund as well as the unemployment insurance fund needs to be reviewed to address the root causes that may be the cause for the inability to attract skills as well as to function correctly as public entities. And lastly, also the forensic investigations into the operations of the fund to make sure that any corrupt elements or any fraudulent activities that may have taken place in the fund, that is identified and dealt with accordingly. So the updates that will be given to the committee along these commitments that were made. With regard to the bringing of skills, so the minister did approve that we, as indicated, that we will seek skills resources from the private sector to come and assist those that have experience in finance, audit, accounting and auditing in particular, to then help with the implementation of clean audit actions, as well as dealing with those areas where we have been unable to attract the relevant skills to deal with those. So we have brought in a team comprising of about 20 personnel who have seconded from FTMG Africa with the relevant experience. So this team has been focused on implementing the action plan and making sure that they assist the fund in preparing for the upcoming audit, as well as assisting with the implementation and monitoring of the key controls that we needed to have put in place to improve the audit outcomes. I think the particular emphasis has been on, while the fund had implemented measures to try and improve controls in the current systems, we still dealt with the issues relating to prior period errors that had been caused by the control weaknesses in the previous systems that we're implementing. So this team has been seized with assisting the office of the CFO to be able to deal with this. The next slide just then gives the, I'll take it as read, Chair. It just highlights those 20 resources that we had brought into the fund. When we go to the audit action plan, so just as a brief, so the main issues that we've been dealing with that have been the areas of concern have been around revenue, around medical benefits, as well as around investments. And these issues have been around the inability to have to provide verifiable information in the format and that the auditors would require to be able to look at the numbers in the financial statements, and also consistency of some of the information and documents that had been requested. So these are the issues that that then the team in its implementation of the work of the Clean Audit Action Plan has been focusing on, the details of which I'll touch on in the subsequent slides. Just as of a recap, so the committee would recall, apologies, there's a typo on the slides that the committee has. It's on the 11th of August, 2021, not necessarily 2022. The DG approved a clean audit action plan that was following our appearance to the committee in June 2021. And this was then aimed at addressing the root causes as well as the various audit findings that we had. And the management over the last 12 months has been then implementing this particular action plan, which covers along the areas of revenue, benefits, outstanding claims, provisions, payables, investments, and so on. And part of the work that we have brought the seconded resources for has been then to implement some of the items related to the Clean Audit Action Plan, particularly with emphasis on the prior period errors, as I indicated. And we have then been able working on these to make sure that we're also able to address the key weaknesses that contributed to misstatements in financial statements, as well as making sure that where controls were lacking, at a processing level, those controls are then implemented. So the whole process that we've actually embarked on, Chair, has been in this journey towards clean audit, has been towards making sure that we develop and embed controls. And this is being done through the implementation of the Clean Audit Action Plan. We also, as part of the audit readiness and interventions, we've also then those controls that have already been implemented And the ones that are being improved as part of the audit readiness interventions, we then go through a process of monitoring and enforcing the implementation of such controls through what we call a key control monitoring tools that has been brought on board by the seconded resources, as well as continuously working on audit readiness to make sure that we, as we prepare the financial statements for the March ending 2022, these are accurate and contain no material misstatements, as has been reported in previous audits by the AG. So this, in summary, this is what the work that has been undertaken by the compensation fund. At a high level, the action plan that we've implemented, so we had about 186 actions that we needed to have implemented, and about 155 of these have been implemented, and about 31 are still due for completion. A substantial portion of them relating to benefits. There's a lot of work that is being done with the Office of the CFO, the seconded resources, as well as consultations that have been happening over the last few months with National Treasury, the Auditor General as well, in some of the areas where there has been some disagreements, as well as areas where we are implementing interventions to just check if those interventions are indeed addressing the issues as had been identified in the audit reports. So these are some of the outstanding work that the team is still busy with, as well as all the prior period issues where previous material misstatements had been identified with regards to benefits, revenue, and investments, and that those are now also being worked on as part of the audit readiness interventions. The approach that has been adopted by the team to, as in the journey towards improving the audit outcomes for the 2021-2022 financial year, as well as the 2022-2023, which is the current financial year that we're in. So the focus has been on our own controls, making sure that it complies with the PFMA, with GRAP, improving the document management processes in the fund, because part of limitations of scope findings had been consistent in the previous management reports from the AG, as well as capacitating the units with particularly the financial management unit with the necessary skills, as well as transfer of skills, and making sure that the quest for clean audit is becoming a daily practice as opposed to just an event at the end of the financial year. And a lot of this has been done through implementing the action plans, as I indicated, making sure that the evidence that supports the implementation is verifiable and the quality is such that is ready for audit, looking at gaps that we are identifying as we assess the implementation of the controls and where there are gaps. These gaps are then being closed as part of the continuous monitoring of the implementation of these controls that we have put in place. And priorities largely given to, if you look at this, the priorities given to those areas that have been the key disclaimer areas, as I've indicated, benefits, investments, and revenue. And we are doing a lot of work to make sure that we then improve the issues that have been identified in the audit. And as I've indicated previously, that we're also doing consultations with National Treasury to particularly in areas where there are disagreements in terms of interpretation of our policies and legislation, as well as the accounting standards between ourselves and the Auditor General, so that we can then get clear guidance so that when we do implement corrective measures, it is also then something that we have National Treasury's advice and input on. If I just go to the status of the interventions that we've then implemented so far with regards to getting ourselves ready for the audits for the 2022-2023 financial year as well, financial years, there has been a lot of work that we've adopted this risk-based approach that I highlighted earlier on with regards to how we deal with development, embedding, as well as monitoring of controls. We have also started some data cleansing work with regards to the prior period errors that have been identified in the previous audit. engagements that are taking place with the Editor General, National Treasury, and the PIC on technical matters, and also part of inculcating the culture of good controls and implementation of controls. Awareness sessions that are taking place with the staff, both from head office as well as the provincial offices. The team of 20 resources that we've brought, as we've indicated, they've also been engaging with the provinces, going to provinces, assisting with the provinces getting ready, particularly with records management issues, as well as making sure that the records that are being audited for claims is easily and readily retrievable and supports the numbers that we see on the financial statements, and also assisting with making sure that we deal quickly with instances where there's identifications of fruitless, wasteful and expenditure and consequence management waiting to happen. That happens. So in order to make sure that even the financial statements that we prepare for the March ending 2022 is accurate and is supported by adequate records, there was a request to postpone the audit for the 31st of March 2022. The DG did then notify the Auditor General as well as National Treasury. And this is the process that enables us to be able to complete the data cleansing that we needed to complete, particularly with all the disclaimers issues, considering that the disclaimers that we have dates back to way even before 2013. So we had then adopted an approach to try and make sure that we can do data analytics on all the financial information that is our financial systems, and where there's instances of misstatements and corrections that needs to be done, those are done and are brought through into the March ending 2022 financial statements, as well as resolving all the technical issues that we had with the Auditor General and National Treasury, so that once we prepare the financial statements and we submit financial statements for audit, these are financial statements that are credible as well as auditable by the AG. So this is the process that we have been engaging in from the beginning of this calendar year. When we look at the work that has been done to get us to the state where we can then be ready for audit, as well as that we have then implemented all the necessary controls. At a high level with regard to data cleansing and making sure that all supporting documentation that supports the numbers on the financial statements, with about 60% completion, and the target here is to complete this process by end of November 2022. The control improvements as well as enhancements of the existing controls, we had about 70%. The target here was to make sure that by 30 September, all the necessary controls that we needed to enhance on the existing ones, these are implemented and embedded by end of September. The preparation of the audit files, particularly with the prior period errors, because we can implement all the good controls in our current systems and make sure that our financial statements, in as far as they reflect the activities that took place in the 2021-2022 financial year, or even 2022-2023, is as accurate as possible. If we don't deal with the prior period errors, it will not improve the audit outcomes, because the numbers that we have in our balance sheet are influenced by numbers that we had in prior period years. And if those years had been disclaimed and we don't deal with those prior period errors, it would not necessarily eliminate the misstatements on the financial statements. So that's the reason why we are particularly focusing on the prior period errors, to make sure that we complete and make sure that those by end of March 2023 this year, these are then dealt with and corrected. And then also on those technical issues, particularly over the interpretation of accounting standards, interpretation of legislation, these are ongoing discussions that are taking place with the AG and with National Treasury. We hope to have those completed by the end of September, so that we can then start implementing whatever the outcomes of those discussions in the remaining months of the financial year, to make sure that the financial statements do reflect the corrected interpretation of the legislation as well as the accounting standards. If I at a high level look at now the details in terms of each of the areas that we've been focusing on to get audit ready around revenue and receivables. So the work that we've been doing here, one of the issues that the AG had always been raising is around the fact that our revenue that we report, there aren't any systems in place to verify information declared by employers, as well as the earnings that the employers use to declare to us for their revenue. So there have been a number of activities that are taking place to try and trace employer files, to make sure that we reconcile the data that we have with other data that is existing within the department, particularly the UIF, CIPC as well, as part of the verification of the earnings and information that has been submitted by employers. We're also looking at our income or our accounts receivable platform with regards to the debtors, validating that the data that we have do actually exist, where we've performed estimations and we've done estimations to arrive at revenue numbers, that these estimations are informed by verified information as well as information that is accurate. So we hope we are about 85% and 65% respectively with regards to the issues of revenue and dealing with all these estimates, and making sure that the data accounts and the listings that we have do correspond to the information that we have in the financials. We anticipate to or expect to complete this by the end of the current financial year. Around the provisions that we have, we're looking also at around the technical provisions that we have as expected in terms of the pensions that we carry on our balance sheet, as well as the outstanding claims reserves. And we want to make sure that here the provisions that are created through actuarial models is supported by accurate information. There is work that we're doing with the actuaries to make sure that the figures that they then produce for the valuations of these reserves is informed by accurate and supportable information and verifiable information. So these ongoing work. So the target here is also to make sure that by end of March 2023, that the amounts that we disclose in the financial statements accurately are reflected in the actuarial report that is produced by actuaries. We're also doing some data analytics to make sure that the payments information that we reflect on our balance sheet and income statement is supported by adequate listings, and where there is discrepancies, those are investigated and cleared, so that we limit the amount of engagements that takes place with the auditors when the differences between the listings and the amounts on the financial statements. We're also looking at the benefit provisions as well, and around benefits, there is making sure that all records that we have with regard to claims are uploaded into the claims management system. Starting from October 2019, all claims that are registered, all documents are scanned and loaded onto the system, but we do have a challenge of any claims prior where these claims would have not been scanned onto the systems, because the systems we're using at the time were not allowing the capability for supporting documentation to be scanned on the claim, and has been one of the reasons why the AG also said that they couldn't obtain adequate records to support the numbers that we have on the financial statements, because we could then provide them with some of the claims information in the format that they wanted. And also to make sure that we also produce the where we the provision for outstanding claims, making sure that it's measured correctly and that it reflects and incorporates all payments that have been made in the current financial year. At about 45% completion with regards to these two activities, but the target is to complete these by end of March 2023. With regard to investments, there is work that we've done. We have, working with the PIC, brought on board auditors that are going to assist us to make sure that we do high-level reviews of the financial statements that have been submitted by the auditee companies, to make sure that we then deal with the issue of delays that we've experienced in the past with regards to obtaining auditable or credible financial statements from the investee companies, and being able to incorporate those into our financial statements on time, as opposed to in the past where we've had to delay auditing on investments because we could not find, or even in some cases, go through the audit without having obtained the information that we needed. Hence, some of the negative audit outcomes with regards to investments in unlisted companies. So there is work that is being done now through these audit firms and the PIC, as well as our team, to get these financial statements verified and correct. So we're sitting at about, we're at 85% in terms of the collection of all these audit statements, audited financial statements, and all these financial statements that support the figures that we have. Target is to complete this by the end of September this year. Around contingent assets, I think this has been the issues around our litigation registers and an ability to obtain accurate listings as well as the exempted employers that we have, who have to submit certain securities that would have to support the assets and liabilities that we have on our balance sheet. So there is work that has been taking place to make sure that we this information is as accurate and complete as possible. And we are about 90% complete there. Target is also to complete this by the end of September this year. And investments in unlisted loans, this is also linked to the investment activities that we're doing in the previous slide. I'll just skip this one, Chair. Around disclosures, these are disclosure issues that the AG had identified in our financial statements for the 2021. So there is work that we then do to make sure that the data that we get from the PIC and the disclosure that we then do in terms of risk management and investments in the financial statements is complete and accurate. That process is currently going through that review and making sure that the information that we now have on investments and the disclosures that we have on investments are accurate and we don't have these administrative issues that have been identified in our financials in the previous financial years. Same issue relating to related parties. These were technical accounting issues, compliance to relevant standards in terms of making sure that all relevant transactions of related parties are taken into account in our financial statements. So as part of the preparation of the audit files and getting audit ready the way the team has been working on these, as well as doing the data analytics to identify, to see if we there's any other related parties that we may have not identified in the current and in the prior years, so that we can then also appropriately disclose those. Target resources to complete this by end of September 2022. Principal agent arrangements, this was one of those technical accounting technical matters that were been source of disagreements in the previous audit. These are issues that we have then also since resolved and agreed with the AG in terms of the interpretation of the accounting standards. So we are now basically putting that through our financial statements to make sure that the disclosure then agrees to the requirements in terms of the relevant GRAP statement. Around fruitless and wasteful expenditure, there has been a lot of work also that has been taking place around to make sure that we produce the registers that is complete, accurate, and where action has to be taking place in terms of actioning the required as per the National Treasury guidelines on irregular fruitless and wasteful expenditure. This work has been ongoing. We're at 80% completion. And the target here is to make sure that by end of October 2022, we have a complete register concurrent to the work that is happening on records, as well as making sure that we improve the accuracy and completeness of the register. There has been ongoing work to monitor and manage the existing cases to get them through the required processes for the guidelines. It's condonement, consequence management has to take place. Also then that being implemented, we have strengthened our processes with regards to dealing with any financial misconduct, and cases then go through this financial misconduct process that we've put in place. And this has helped us to be able to start working through these cases much faster. This is just the next subsequent slide, just basically just gives the plans in terms of the next approach and strategies, as well as the plans we have with regard to being audit ready and implementation of the action plan. I'll just take that as read, Chair, and maybe just take the committee through some of the initiatives that we've implemented as part of this clean audit actions, the work that is being done by through the office of the Chief Financial Officer and the seconded resources in the office. The data analytics has been one of the key things. Data analytics is a process that the team has chosen to be able to help deal with the prior period issues. So there are exceptions that have been identified out of these this analytics that is now being worked through with the teams to identify if there's any possibility of duplicates or any fraudulent payments that may be identified, just verification of whether these are indeed duplicate, fraudulent, or valid exceptions. And also, we also going through the same process also with our revenue, particularly with employers, as well as premium records that we have on our books. So this ongoing work is going to then result in some of the transactions that will pass to address the prior period errors, where there is, and also where we're able then to support our reconciliations with correct evidence of the correct exceptions. We will then also be able to do that through the outcomes of this data analytics process that has taken place. We also, one of the things that we're using to track the audit findings, as well as track the implementation of the controls that we've put in place, we are using an iTrack tool that then helps us with the in real time, basically, to review the control designs, to assist in the monitoring of the control findings, as opposed to monitoring this and managing this manually outside using spreadsheets and so on, and also providing, helping us to deal with repeat findings and make sure that we implement adequate controls to avoid some of these repeat findings that we have. The tool has been embedded into the fund, and the teams have been taken through the use of the tool, and this is over the next few months we'll be implementing this tool to make sure that it helps us to deal decisively and quickly with the resolutions of commitments we've made with regards to addressing the audit findings, where the findings have been found, and also where we've implemented controls that we monitor the implementation of these controls across the organization. If I go to the next commitment that the minister had made was around the review, the architecture review of the compensation fund and the unemployment insurance fund. So we embarked on a process and to appoint a service provider that would then do the diagnostic review of the organizations as they exist, looking at strategy, structure, systems, the leadership, staff, skills, shared values, and then identifying where the gaps are and what is it that the needs to be put in place to make sure that the two entities operate as intended in terms of the PFMA as public, as Schedule 3A public entities, and where there is gaps that have been identified across the seven SSS, as I've indicated here, then those are then put, are the interventions are recommended to be put in place. This is one of the interventions that the minister has then put in place to make sure that we improve the way that these organizations are designed, and it will help us also to be able to, with the interventions and the recommendations that come up, to be able to attract the skills that we need in the organization, to be able to implement systems as well as ICT and otherwise that would then be able to support the nature of the business of the two entities, and making sure that the structure that we have also then supports the mandate of the two entities and is able to allow them to deliver on their mandates. So this is the high level project plan in terms of this architecture review. The project started in March this year after the procurement processes were completed to appoint the service provider. And we have then been working over the last 6 months with the service provider, and there has been a number of milestones that have been reached. We actually currently now at a stage where we are reviewing the SE's report in terms of the analysis that of the SE's environment, and the work that is starting now over the next 12 months would then be to look at each of these areas and start looking at what is it that needs to be put in place to improve on the SE's environment and across these seven S's that I highlighted in the previous slide. And that report, once it's completed at the end of August 2023, will then be submitted to the DG as the accounting authority and the minister as the executive authority for then making sure that interventions that have been recommended are implemented to get the funds operating the way that they are intended in terms of legislation. This is just a slide that just gives the high level process in terms of where we are with the development of the SEIS report, the change management interventions that have taken place also as part of the this particular project, and the technology assessment that has been done to look at the systems and look at the particularly the network security systems that we have put in place and what improvements needs to be done, because the two entities do deal with a large number of transactions, personal data, as well as sensitive financial data that needs to be protected to make sure that it doesn't fall in the wrong hands, and also that it's utilized for its intended purpose. So that's where we are with the architecture review. We are completing the project at the end of September 2023. We're expecting the final report to be ready by end of August 2023 and go through the approval processes in September 2023, with then the implementation that some of the interventions would go through a concurrent implementation of the improvements as the project is ongoing over the next 12 months. But majority of the actions will then be implementable based on the final report at the end of August next year. One of the other commitments that had been made was around the forensic investigations that needed to take place. Following our appearance to the committee also, we then needed to follow a procurement process to get the resources on board that would then help us to investigate across areas of the business of the compensation fund. And we have appointed the service providers over for a 5-year to do a 5-year review of all the transactions that have taken place in the fund. And these are transactions that are taking place over the various areas that I'll just highlight quickly now on the presentations and subsequent slides. But these are the five companies that have been appointed to carry out these investigations: Bowman, Abacus, SNG, and TSF Africa, Nexus, as well as Stone 10. We completed the contracting with these service providers. It was a lengthy process to get the contracts signed as they were doing the to and fro, as well as having to get the necessary POPIA disclaimers put in place due to the data that the companies will be dealing with, which also contain some of the personal information of our claimants. So all those processes were then completed around February 2022, and the project then started from that point. So we've divided the work into these eight work packages, covering medical expenses, pensions, temporary disability payouts, permanent disability payouts, all other COID benefits that we pay, the issues related to revenue, particularly the return of earnings and the information that employers do submit to the fund, the whole processes around how we deal with that, as well as the information that has been submitted by companies, investments and associates and subsidiaries, all our unlisted investigations also is one of the work packages. I spoke about issues around network security earlier on, so cyber investigations in terms of the network security, where there has been instances of any network breaches, I think these investigations will also then look at those areas of conflict of interest, looking at supply chain, the whole procure to pay process from supply chain process all the way to the payment of service providers. That's also another work package. And the last one around financial statements, reporting fraud. So the work has been divided to amongst the service providers along these phases. Basically, in terms of where we are here, so the identification and initiation of the service providers, this has been done. This was a given. That's the process that we embarked on over the last half of last year to get the service providers appointed. The implementation plan with each of the service providers also is in progress in terms of the areas that they have been given. And alongside with the planning as well as the implementation plan, they're actually now starting with the actual execution of the field work. there has been a lot of requests for information that has been sent through by the service providers, as well as engagements with the internal teams to get any information that they need, and reporting on in terms of the cases that they've completed. This hasn't started because it's only now that the planning and the execution has started, and the reports will not all be completed at the same time. As each investigation is completed, those reports would then be submitted for implementation of the recommendations, and where we would then also be updating the committee on those as we complete those investigations. So this is just the details of what I was saying, just showing in terms of the work packages, what that entails, and when the kickoff meetings have commenced. So in all the subsequent slides, we basically then indicating under each with medical expenses. We started on the 27th of June, and this is the stage where we are with regards to compensation benefits, so pensions and permanent and temporary disability payouts. Also, this work started also on the 27th of June with the planning, as well as meeting with the relevant officials within the fund to get information. Same thing with the revenue from an exchange. It started on the 28th of July, with the investments also started around the 28th of June. Conflict of interest around the same, as well as the accounts payable or the procure to pay, which started on the 27th of June. It is also then those ongoing engagements that are taking place with service providers and the financial statements fraud. Also, meeting kicked off in July, and there is also that ongoing engagement that are taking place with the service providers. Chair, that brings me to the end of my presentation. And thank you very much.
All right, thank you very much. Yeah. Right, colleagues, on that compensation presentation, just leaves more questions. Right, colleagues, check our, okay. Colleagues, any questions? I thought there was, all right, Honorable Mkhonto.
Good morning, Chair, honorable members, colleagues from the Compensation Fund led by the Commissioner, Ubab Mafat. So, Chair, I welcome the presentation, but then I need to be clarified in as far as he said there will be transfer of skills from those seconded to the fund. I did not hear as to how are these skills going to be retained. And I think I'm in order to say there has been a culture of non-compliance and non-accountability in the fund. And I did not hear as to how is the fund going to deal with that particular culture. Because Chair, the imparting of knowledge might be a temporary intervention, then how is the fund going to ensure that it doesn't regress back into them getting those negative audit outcomes from the Auditor General? Those are my two questions, Chair. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you. Maybe let's take three sets of colleagues and then we will carry on. So Honorable Liz and Honorable Mkhalipi in that order.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, and good morning to colleagues and guests. It is yet another report of some progress, but I would have hoped to get some completions of many of these things, but be that as it may, it is what it is, I'm afraid. Mr. Chairman, let's just start with the annual assessments or the returns of earnings. What progress has been made to ensure that those are sent out to employers, in other words, reminders to submit them? Associated with that is, what is the backlog of return of earnings that have yet to be submitted and which years, how many years back, and for each year, what is the backlog? And that then leads me on to the next thing, question. What is the mechanism that the Compensation Commission uses to ensure that all employers are registered and submit the returns and make the payments? What is the method that those are the all employers are brought into the net? Is there a link perhaps to SARS, or are there inspectors out there with all the small businesses who employ people and who are very vulnerable to employment accidents and so on, which they can't claim for if the employer is not registered? Chairman, the next point really is my perennial with regard to this website. It works, it doesn't work, but even when it is working, as it is this morning, I've just been on it, in order to get through, you've actually got to log in twice. I mean, it's the most absurd thing that you log in and then you go to the next step and then it says log in a second time. And then, yeah, so it's just not user friendly. Bearing in mind that this is a website that's only used once a year by employers. So every time they've got to go in, they've got to start learning what it all means, where to put in a simple thing like your username. If you click on username, nothing happens. You've got to click on a blank space below username, but no box or anything. You just got to guess, well, this is where I'm going to put it in. And so, I mean, that to me, the user friendliness is something that should have been dealt with a very long time ago, particularly as I've been raising it for many years. The next question deals with specific numbers, Mr. Chairman. Is the Compensation Commission call center and whoever deals with emails able to deal with every single call that comes in and every single email that comes in every single day? If not, what is the backlog? How many emails are waiting reply? And calls, of course, people just get frustrated and can't get through. So there's no real backlog, but how many calls try to get through and how many can actually be dealt with? The incredible thing here, Mr. Chairman, is about the non-listed investments. We've been talking about these for years. We've had the Empati Commission report on the PIC, and yet we have today a situation where Vuyo tells us that they haven't got on top of these yet. You can't even get basic things like financial statements out of some of them. So why are we still invested there? Why have we not withdrawn our investments? If there's no financial statements, withdraw the investment. And if you can't withdraw the investment, why can't you withdraw it? So that leads to the next question. Of the ones that have now been able to see financial statements, how many of those are actually solvent and how many are insolvent? In other words, what is the value of the investments there? And Mr. Chairman, I would request that the committee request the compensation commissioner to provide a full report of all unlisted investments and the status of each. Have we received annual financial statements? Are they solvent? What action is being taken to protect the investment? I don't think that we all can answer that verbally now, but I do believe we should get a full written report on those unlisted investments. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
So thanks, Honorable Liz. Honorable Mkhalipi, and then the Compensation Fund will come in to respond.
Thank you very much, Chair. Good morning to colleagues. I just want to get a clarity because, Chair, the what was presented here by Vuyo, we hear that there will be there is a plan in terms of addressing issues in terms of resources, and I just want to take over of what from my colleague, a member of Parliament, Khosi. Because the secondment of resources for the office of the chief financial officer, and you are told that there are 20 people that are already been identified. But my question is to Vuyo, it seems as if we are not concentrating on the people who get affected when they get injured at work. So I just want to get their plan currently, how to address that, because people get injured at work. And when they want to follow proper procedures to be compensated, the employer seems to be very, very, very difficult to assist those people. Remember, Chair, we are talking about people who have lost their work, who does not have a life after what happened to them at work when they get injured. And then now when they want to get their money from the employer, when they have to go to the Department of Labor, it seems as if there's no coordination, a clear coordination in order to assist people. If they can speak exactly to that, so we can also advise people who have come with those kind of challenges to us as members, as activists, in order for us to know. Because most of the time, when we said go to the Department of Labor, they come back empty-handed because we know the challenges of Department of Labor, especially at local government. If he can address that now, where can our people can be assisted instead of getting very difficulties with the employer, as the Honorable Member of DA was saying here, it seems as if there's no capacity in terms of the inspectors of the department to ensure that all employers are registered to start with, let alone when a person gets injured on duty. So there's a case that I'm dealing with now currently in Northwest, and I'm happy to say that the DG of the department is very responsive in some of the cases when you talk to him. But what is disappointing is that person who got injured 5 years, 6 years, 10 years, or whatever years ago, when he goes to the department, it seems as if cases are not registered. So if I can get that coordination whereby people can get easy information and can be assisted and can at least have life after they get injured from work, it will be easy for us. Thank you very much, Chairman.
All right, thank you very much. Let's get responses from the Compensation Fund.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I'm going to then respond, and I'm going to just ask two of my colleagues to also add on some of the, on two of the questions that have been asked here, three of the questions, Chair. So the first question from Honorable Mkhonto, around the transfer of skills. I think, so how the team has been, so the team has been integrated into the operations of the fund, particularly in finance. So they're working hand in hand with the officials of the fund, and that's how we then dealing with the issues of skills transfer, because then they're integrated into the team and they're guiding and assisting with the executing of the day-to-day finance work, particularly with regards to the implementation of controls and the issues around making sure that we don't regress. I spoke about the iTrack tool in my presentation that we are using that now to start monitoring the implementation of controls as well as the monitoring of the implementation of the recommendations from the audit findings. So that's one of the ways that we are making sure that we try and manage this process so that we don't regress. Once we've implemented a control and it's embedded, we make sure that people continuously follow through on it and make sure that they consistently implement it. It's still at the infancy stage, but that's something that we're now implementing to try and embed the culture of implementing good controls. With Honorable Liz's questions around the return of earnings. So the return of earnings are an automated function. So employers submit their returns online. We then assess the employers on the system. It's not the old process where we then have to send out the returns of earnings by post. They would have to submit the returns of earnings by post as well or email. We then sit and assess those return of earnings such that it ends up with backlogs, and only then do we then enable the employers to get the letters of understanding. It's an automated process currently. You only have a few isolated cases of employers that would submit their returns manually. I think the big issue that Honorable Liz may be talking about is the issues around those employers who have been assessed and then I end up being flagged for audit because of the discrepancies that have been identified in their returns that have been submitted in the current year compared to the prior year, and such that they then flagged for audit. Julian Supen will come in after this and just give the numbers in terms of the where we are with the players who are flagged for audit and what are the numbers and what we are doing to deal with that. But just to talk to the question on the what are we doing to ensure that the employers submit the returns. So there's a number of interventions that we put in place. The first one was the creation of payroll auditors within the inspection and enforcement branch in the department, which are fully funded by the compensation fund. So this unit then helps us to audit employers and work through compliance issues with employers who are not complying with the law. And they have specific focus. These are inspectors who are specialized and their sole focus is on working on non-compliant employers. We also work with the, I think one of the things that we've also put in place has been the collaboration that we've participated in with CIPC in terms of the creation of the BIS portal where employers who create, who register companies and register through the CIPC, they can automatically also then get a registration for compensation fund and be able to then get all their registrations done at one place, as opposed to having to move from one space to the other to get their registration. And that also helps us to catch also the employers who are newly registering companies so that they don't fall out of the net. We have embarked on a process to simplify our assessment process in terms of the reduction of assessment classes or industries. The minister published a new regulation about 2 years ago that was reducing the number of classes that we use to assess employers. This is one of the interventions that has been put in place to try and simplify the process so that employers don't have to go through the complex process of assessments and registration with the compensation fund. And these interventions also aimed to improve compliance amongst many other things. On the issue that with the website, so the department has one entry for all employers who do business with the department. So for a person who wants to use online platforms of the Department of Employment and Labor, they first have to register on the department's website to be able to do that. And once they've registered with the department website, only then, and only for claims purposes, do they then need to do a separate registration on the claims administration system. But with regard to employers who are submitting the returns, there's only one process. Once you've registered as a user on the department system, you can use the same registration to be able to then log on to the specific systems of the compensation fund to be able to submit the returns. It doesn't necessarily require the two logins. But we're happy to look at the specific incidents that Honorable Liz is referring to so that we can check what would have prompted him to do two logins when it only requires one login for the submitting of returns of earnings. Mr. Mudiba will just maybe just talk on the Johnny Mudiba will talk on the numbers in terms of the drop rates that we have in the call center. Like any other call center, we do receive calls. There are calls that don't get attended to within the time that the person is calling, as well as some of the inquiries that we get through emails and so on. So to be able to give those numbers. The issue of investments. So one of the things, so it's not so easy to get out of these investments necessarily without necessarily incurring or exposing the compensation fund to further losses. Because unlisted investments, unlike listed investments where you can find a buyer anywhere, with unlisted investments, they're kindly illiquid. And when you invest for the long term. So at the time when you want to get out of an investment in the short term, you may not necessarily realize the benefits that you intended with that particular investment. So it's not as easy, but we are trying to bring in improvements. We have worked with the PIC to try and bring in improvements around the accountability for the companies that they invest in, as well as making sure that some of these administrative processes in future investments around timely submission of financial statements, the timely submission of audited financial records as well, that gets done and gets incorporated into the agreements that the PIC would enter into with the companies when they do enter into these investments. And because of some of these interventions that we put in place, we are reviewing our agreement that we have with the PIC to just take into account some of these things. And because of that, we've actually just slowed down investments, unlisted investments, to allow for a lot of these interventions that we've put in place to improve things that these to get then implemented. We will submit the list that is requested. We do have that list. I think it's readily available in terms of each investment, whether we've received financial statements or not, which are investments that are currently going through liquidation. So we'll provide that information to the committee at the end of this meeting. Okay, going to Honorable Mkalipi's question. So if you look at the seconded resources, we focused on finance because that's one area where we've had challenges with regards to bringing in the relevant skills and also upskilling and getting our current officials to be able to deal with some of the more complex issues. But in our other areas, core business and so on, we have done a lot of work. In 2017, the minister approved a new structure for the compensation fund, which allowed us to be able to attract a number of qualified medical personnel as well as claims personnel that we brought on board. So in these particular areas, the issue of skills is not as severe, and as a result, we have not sought any additional resources to come and help us deal with it. The issue around the people challenges that the people have, one of the investments that we've made as the fund has been an investment in creating and improving the capacity in occupational health and safety inspectors in the department. So the compensation fund has taking over the funding for occupational health and safety inspections as the form of assisting with prevention of occupational injuries and diseases. And this is the additional capacity that has been brought in the inspectorate to help us to make sure. So when people have challenges with employers who don't report accidents, who don't report incidents, the mechanisms and avenues that are open to them is to be able to report these to inspectors, because this is a non-compliance to the law. And if any person goes to a labor center and reports to the inspectors, then the inspectors would then go out and do the necessary investigations. If they need to compel an employer to submit, they would then compel an employer. If it's an old claim, they would also then compile the necessary reports that would enable us to be able to then process the claim using the reports that we obtain from the inspectors. But we have also made available. So one of the things that we wanted to do is to make sure that employers also don't have any administrative impediments to them registering and submitting claims. Hence, we've made available an online platform for them to do the registrations of claims. Part of the improvements that we want to do now to the system is to allow the injured workers as well. Currently, the legislation allows for an employer to submit a claim on behalf of the employee, but we haven't had the administrative process for an employee who wants to check whether my claim has indeed been registered in the system or not. So these are some of the things that we are looking at to see how we can then improve the system to get the claimants themselves, if they want to make an inquiry and check whether their claims have been registered or not. And we're just investigating the mechanisms that we can be able to do that as part of the improvements to the existing claims system. So if I can just ask Mr. Supan just to talk on the issue of the audits, and then Mr. Mudiba to just talk on the issue of the cost and budget. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair, honorable members and colleagues and guests. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Chairperson. So in terms of those employers who are flagged for audit, currently we're sitting at around 11,000 employers who are flagged for audit. That number fluctuates from month to month as new employers are flagged, and then the old ones are assessed and cleared. There's a number of interventions that we have to address these employers who come through and are flagged for audit. First and foremost, once an employer is flagged for an audit, he's issued with a notice. And the notice clearly outlines the list of requirements that we require from the employer in order to clear the audits. In the main, we require a full set of financials from that employer in order to do that assessment and to clear that particular audit. Over and above that, apart from sending out the notices, we've actually implemented a new development on the ROE online system. And once the employer submits the ROE, and the system will indicate or will calculate whether that employer is flagged for audit or not, and will automatically issue a notice to that employer online and list all the requirements that the employer needs to submit. So often the employer already knows exactly what to submit to in order to for the fund to assess that audit and to clear it. Over and above that, Chair, what we have done is we've done an outbound exercise to all the employers who are flagged for audit, apart from these notices that we sent and apart from the electronic notification that goes out to the employer on the ROE's online system. Is through our call center, we did an outbound exercise to the employers to request for information. A number of that information has come in and has gone through an assessment process. And then over and above that, Chair, we have also got resources in place who will visit some of these employers, especially those employers who have not responded to these various requests, to call upon those employers and to request for those particular supporting information that we need. Thank you, Chairperson.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Johnny Mudiwa. I'm the COO in the Compensation Fund. I'm going to answer the question raised by honorable Liz with regards to the contact center and also the statistics in terms of the number of calls and the resolution rates, as well as the number of emails that are received by the Compensation Fund. So looking at the calls first, and also the recent report that was presented to us in the Compensation Fund ending August, for the month of August, we received 37,515 number of calls, and we managed to answer 34,350 of those calls, which is giving us the answer rate of 92%. And then if we look at the key performance indicator or the standard that we set ourselves to achieve, we've managed to bypass that performance standard. And the 8% in terms of the calls that could not be answered within the standards and the turnaround time. Normally what we do is we then outbound, we do an outbound session where we then call back the clients that could not, you know, reach us, you know, for us to be able to assist them. So on average, based on the report that we get, we have an average handling time of 7 minutes. So the most of the complicated, you know, calls will take just over 7 minutes, but we are able to then address most of the concerns within the 7 minutes, which is then the average handling time of the call. And then looking at the emails, on average per month we get in 7,916 emails. So from April up to August 2022, in total, the emails that we got are 39,508. And we managed to resolve 3,104 of those. So 36,476 have been then dispatched to the back office, the various business units in the compensation fund, so that they are then being able to be resolved, you know, accordingly. So the challenge that we normally experience here is that in the same period of April to August 2022, over and above the 39,580, we receive normally junk emails, up to 70,000. So from April to August, we have been receiving junk emails. So we normally, before we look into the valid emails that we need to then respond to, we have to undergo a cleaning process, you know, to just remove those junk emails, which is something that, you know, takes a little bit of time to address. And then, but then once we then have identified the valid emails that we need to respond to, we answer them immediately with the relevant clients and then maybe seek additional information from clients. Then once we have managed to get the relevant information, we then resolve what we can as customer care or the office of the COO. But then the rest of the other emails that we get, we then dispatch to the back office to be able to assist us accordingly. So those are the averages. So we get emails from different sources. Like we have an inbound unit which receives dedicated emails, and then some of the emails are handled by the working centers that we have and service delivery improvement units that we have. So those are the statistics. So in terms of ensuring that we monitor, we improve on the oversight, especially on emails, because on calls, I'm quite happy in terms of the performance that we're having. But on emails every week, Monday, I'm receiving a report on how many emails have been received on that particular week. So it will be in the region of about 3,000 or so emails that are received. So I monitor how far then the emails are in terms of resolution, how long it takes, you know, for back office to then address such emails. So I'm providing close oversight in terms of the emails that are received, because that is the area that we need to realize a great improvement going forward. Thank you very much, honorable members.
All right, is that the end of the responses?
Thank you, Chair. We've responded to all the questions, Chair.
All right, Honorable Somu and Honorable Lees.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think I wish to note the presentation by the Compensation Fund, which relates to matters that we somewhat raised and arise out of the deliberation that we have previously. What I would want to know, just in one sentence, the commissioner, if you would sum up one sentence, as what is your assertion on the progress required in terms of settling the stability of your entity, just in one sentence. Secondly, that taking note of a number of consultants which are used, which I would prefer them, if you can't do it now, I don't have a problem, they can come back to us, maybe in writing on that. Just list those consultants involved, the cost per consultant, and the required objective or outcome the consultant and expected timelines for completion of that a piece of work, which would come out to us as an accountability frame for success or failure of engagement of such consultants. Then the last thing, which is based on such, what is expected level of a skilled transfer from each of those consultants engaged. I'm asking so because there is a realization which has been confirmed through the report that the skill deficit is a huge challenge when it comes to the compensation fund. And the last area would be the area of note, which relates to the acknowledgement of the fact that yes, indeed, if we have the HTS to succeed or to show success, it must go back as much as possible to deal with areas which have been cited by the Auditor General, and for it to be able on the current financials to depict a desired a change or impact. The problem which I would want us to look into is to balance the fact that all those things are done as you go, because as you go, you spend, as you go, you service, as you go, you ought to serve the populated beneficiaries in your system. At the same time, you have to register, you see, those who participate in the compensation fund for beneficiaries' interests. And how then do you create a context of a balance between what you want to go back at and what you are doing in a balance to a future which is of a standard practice in as far as success is concerned? Thank you very much, Chair.
Right. Honourable Leith and Honourable Bukas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your and your team for the answers. Just to me, I'm not properly in the loop, but my information is that, and I'm not talking about postal assessments for you, that those I stopped doing many years ago, and my old clients stopped many years ago. But no one seems to get a notice to say, Joe, so your annual assessment is due. Click on this link and register if you haven't registered. Otherwise, submit your return. And then a month later or 2 weeks later, a reminder. And that's all so easily possible in today's IT environment. And yet, I'm not aware of anything like that. I'm not talking about something coming through the post. I'll be making a speech about the post office on Thursday. So we'll hear about that then. Then in terms of ensuring employers are registered, I mean, it's great to have a one-stop shop through the CIPC, and that's great for investment and people making investments in the economy. Congratulations, that really is great. But actually, it doesn't capture the majority of employers who operate either as sole proprietors or as little co-ops or whatever. And those are the employers that employ people and don't meet their requirements, statutory requirements in terms of the compensation fund, the unemployment fund, etc. Those are the ones that really do need to be brought into the net to protect the very employees who find themselves uncovered in the event of an injury. So that's the, but well done on linking to the CIPC. I think that's a great step. Obviously, the issue of unanswered emails is a massive issue, and weekly meetings and close oversight are important, but there doesn't, by now there shouldn't be, there should be action taken and not requiring weekly oversight. I didn't hear how that's going to be achieved. And then in terms of the unlisted investments, great that you've got a full report for us coming for you, but perhaps you can just give us a one figure now then, if that report is easily available, is what is the value of those unlisted investments right now, or whatever the latest date is, even the end of July or end of August, whatever the report date is. Perhaps you could give that to us now. And then I'm a little bit disappointed to hear you say you've slowed down. I would have thought you would have stopped those investments altogether until you've got control of how they operate. Mr. Chairman, I think that those are the only on the browser. Vuyo, you have to log in twice every time. You log in once, then you go to the next screen, and then they ask you to log in again. I've tried many different ways. Thanks.
Honorable Bukas.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Mr. Mafata, for the presentation. Chair, they are disclaimed since 2013, but in presenting this report and the measures they've put in place, I don't get a sense of they really want to change the situation. Because, Chair, under actions to address the disclaimers, the response is just it will be reviewed by management. They will prepare a register for consequence management, but they're not clear who will prepare this record. Under clean audit initiatives, they will do this and do that. I don't know, Chair, maybe it's the English, but for me, it's very broad. So my question therefore is, Chair, are there a dedicated official to drive the clean audit action plan? And what measures are there to monitor and enforce it? I'm just concerned, Chair, that if we don't have a dedicated official, we will sit with the same issues like we are sitting for the past years. Thank you, Chair.
All right, let's get responses, and then the UIF will come in after that.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks to the honorable members for the questions and comments. Honorable Samuel, so I think in one sentence, we are satisfied with the progress so far. On the list of consultants, we will make that list available in terms of the costs involved, objectives, expected timelines of completion, and also talk on the issues of the expected level of skills transfer. So we will talk on that. I think that one comment that you raised around the going back as far as possible. So one of the discussions that we're having with National Treasury is the issue of how far back can we go, because the fund has been a disclaimed audit environment even before 2013. So it has been chronically getting adverse audit opinions for almost its existence. So we're trying to look at how far back can we correct the issues so that it doesn't create a problem when we start correcting from 2013 going forward, and we then have issues of 2012 and below. So those are ongoing discussions with the relevant authorities. Honorable Liz, I think we take note of the, I think that's an improvement that we'll then need to make, because currently we've been relying mainly on, so what we do is we've got these campaigns at the beginning of the filing season, because the filing period is legislated when employers must submit, which is the 1st of March at the beginning of every year to the end of May. So we have been publishing this and reminding employers in terms of the legislated dates and so on. But I think the improvement in terms of the notice, which has a link and so on, that would go a long way towards also improving the levels of compliance and the speed within which employers submit their returns. So we'll definitely take that into account in our ongoing enhancements of the system. So you're correct that the CIPC doesn't capture most of the employers because it only takes into account incorporated companies. But one of the things that we've done because of that gap is the creation of an online registration platform for all other forms of businesses, whether it's a sole proprietor, it's a cooperative, it's a trust, or a partnership, or any unincorporated form of entity. They're then able to do their registrations with us online using the ROE online system. We do also take note of the issues around the unanswered emails, the consequence management and issues. I think there is stringent performance agreements that the COO would enter into with the officials in the call center, as well as those that are supervising the officials. And we manage that through then the performance management system to make sure that those that don't perform are held to account accordingly and follow then all those processes as prescribed in the public service performance management process. I'll ask Mr. Kota to just touch on the values of the unlisted investments, but we will still provide that list because we'll then give the details in terms of which entities have been under liquidations and which ones are still active investments. I think the issue around the comment around slowing down. So at the time when we made the decision that we want to review the investments, and were already processes that the PIC had already started with some of the investments and the commitments that had been made with regard to some of the investments. So we're allowing for those to be able to continue. What we've done though is that with the revised mandate to the PIC, we have put in some measures in terms of things that we expect them to include in the agreements when they conclude those the processes related to those investments. So that's what we meant when we said we slow down. But as opposed as to whether we're looking at any new investments, we are necessarily not looking at any new investments at all, save for those that it already started. So honorable vehicles, so in this plan, we had to be as summarized as possible. So for every action that we have in the plan, there is a corresponding official that is responsible for activities there. The performance agreements, starting from all the executives in the fund, going all the way down to officials at operational level, we do have these in our performance agreements in terms of the implementation of these action plans. So everybody is being assessed around them. That's how we then hold officials to account and making sure that for each of the actions that we have in the action plan, there is actually people that are doing that particular job and we're able to monitor the that through some of those agreements. And then with the dedicated resources, we do have dedicated resources in the Clean Audit Initiative who are solely focusing on it. So in addition to the 20 resources we spoke about in the presentation, we have some of the officials within the fund who have also been seconded into the team to make sure that they drive and manage the clean audit action plan initiatives as we have them in our plan. Thank you very much, Chair. Maybe Mr. Kota can just touch on the values, the investment values.
Good morning, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, colleagues, and all who have attended the meeting. So as we are sitting now, I'm going to be just giving the values as at 30th of June of the unlisted investment. The total value of unlisted investment is 2 billion. 162 million, so it's 2.162 billion. This is made up of the following categories of investments. We are looking at firstly the first category will be the equities, the investment in equities. The value there we are sitting at 421 million. The original cost was about 518 million. So it has gone down a little bit with some companies who are not performing. There are just some few companies like AFGRI, which is basically, Chair, there's Africa Oil that is really not performing there, which is under liquidation. We've got Fountain Civil Engineering, which is really not doing well. And then lastly, we've got Zamalwandle. Those are the categories of investments that are not giving us pleasure, and there are mechanisms that PIC is following. So we will provide such information on the report. And then the second categories, we've got equity funds, which is sitting at 1.2 billion. And the original cost was about 1.2 billion as well. So that category is doing fairly well. And the last category is the unlisted loans, which is sitting at a value of 532 million. And then we had put in there about 1.2 billion. So there's a couple of investments that are not doing well there, which includes LA Crushers, Musa Capital, Medipost, and then those are the major ones. And then we shall give the full report, Chairperson, following this meeting. Thank you.
All right. All right, colleagues, is that it? I think we can move on to the... just when do you anticipate submitting your report? Your annual report?
Chair, we will submit the report together with the 2023. Based on the work that we're doing now, we'll only be able to submit the financial statements for audit at the end of March 2023.
Yeah. I don't know about this. It comes across as kicking for touch. And that, well, something is being done, and given your history, it's an easy way out. Something fundamentally just doesn't sit well with me. This entire there's something that's not there. There's something missing. And I'm just trying to put my finger on it. Because the road that we have traversed with the compensation fund is one that says if you are not kept within reach, then nothing gets done. You've had a long history of disclaimers and absence of consequences. And so now it's like, okay, well, until March 2023, just sit in hope. And no, there's just, I've been trying to wrap my head around this, and I just, something doesn't sit well with me. How much are these consultants costing you that you've got there? I mean, I know you've spoken about integration of skills and so on, but what's the cost of all of this?
I think the contracted amount is around 20 million for over the 12-month period.
$20 million.
That is made with the salaries that we're paying to the seconded resources, Chair.
Yeah, something just doesn't add up. But we'll get to it. We'll figure it out. It's okay. Colleagues, I think we can bring it to an end with the compensation fund, unless there's anything else. And if there isn't, can we welcome the presentation by the UIF? That conversation. Thank you very much, UIF. Over to you.
Morning, members and chair. Mr. Mafata will be walking us through the presentation. Chair, I think I'm going to take the tune from your message to Ntate Mafata about focusing on the salient areas. So I'll shoot straight, Chair, to slide number 5. On slide number 5, Chair, what we are reflecting here are the 12 priorities that is URF would single out to focus on. And I think those areas that link to this committee in particular is 1, fraud cases and risk management. Number 2 is fruitless, wasteful and irregular expenditure. I think this was raised sharply in the previous meeting. Slide number 5 in the Dima Fund. And the third one is COVID tests, follow the money, and then the clean audit. And lastly, information technology was raised sharply in the previous engagement. And so I'm just going to focus on the 5 ones. And if you go to slide number 6, I think, Chair, here on slide number 6, what I'm lifting out here is the progress we've made with respect to clean audit. We've set up a plan with respect to us arriving at a clean audit. Amongst those is a clean audit action plan. And we've got this clean audit plan subjected to internal audit to review to make sure that the controls are preventative and detective so that you avoid similar activities happening in the future. And at the time when they did the first audit, they picked up 24% of our action plan had shortcomings, which we ultimately addressed and they were attended to. I can indicate, Chair, that as of quarter one, we had a 50% target, which we've achieved. But as we speak now, we're sitting at 60% in terms of implementation of our audit action plan. Now, this is linked to 60% is linked to us, to our audit being finalized towards the end of March this year. So if you go to slide number 7, and I might just emphasize here, I'm just lifting up the salient areas, then I'll delete the rest when to the questions. In slide number 7, the Duma Fata, here is follow the money project. It's follow the money project, Chair. What I'm confirming in this slide is with our follow the money project, UIF has paid 61 billion rands to just over 250,000 companies for about 4.7 million employees. To date, we had employed about 6 auditors to go and confirm in these companies if indeed money was transferred to the rightful owners. 14 billion rands was confirmed as having been correctly paid. As a result of that exercise, we had 3.2 billion rands being paid directly back into our accounts by auditors. Some of them, I assume, it was triggered by the fraud cases that were in the media and the people that were arrested and some who were convicted in court. We can go to slide number 8. I think slide number 8, Chair, the emphasis here. I'm going to cover this when I'm reporting on the final investigation report. So I'll skip this slide, Chair. And then go to slide number 12. Chair, on slide number 12, I'm just highlighting here the 62% breakdown that we've achieved in terms of our clean audit plans, the areas where we've already implemented and where we are making progress, and the areas where it's still working in progress and we're still working with the cases. And I think as Ntate Mafata said in his presentation, the DG is driving a clean audit as a daily proactive action that all the staff members must undertake. Chair, if you go to slide number 15, here, Chair, what I'm lifting up for the members to know is that AG, when they came and audited our COVID test payments, they picked up a number of areas. Slide number 15. They pick up a number of areas. Chair, what I'm lifting up in this slide is that 89% of the findings has been implemented. We are remaining with three findings. I think in particular here, these are the areas that we need to verify with social development, the NPOs. We also need to verify invalid ID numbers. Oftentimes, the invalid ID numbers are your foreign nationals' ID numbers. And also we have the case data sitting with SIU, which is your SANDF data. Just to confirm that, yes, these indeed were deserving applicants for the project. If you can go to slide number 17, I think, Chair, what I'm lifting up here is our clean audit plan. I'm also just going to lift up the area of focus. The first point is we have an iTrack progress platform that we're using currently. What this iTrack enabled us is for us to track systematically all the audit action plans, to put all the supporting documents, and also to have all the relevant sign-off taking place, but it take place online. And this enabled us to audit the process. When the internal audit audits, they audit on the platform and people can submit and upload their documents online. We have also introduced a control self-assessment where each manager of the unit does a control self-assessment of the environment to pick up if there's any issues in their controls. And also linked to our control self-assessment, we've introduced or we've asked internal audit as part of their consulting services to review the control environment at URF and test all the controls and give us advice on areas where they still need for us to close controls. It's a project that has already started in July and we anticipate to receive their report end of September. The other area is the loss control committee. What the loss control committee is our committee that reviews all the irregular expenditure and confirm if it is irregular, and if it's irregular, it is subjected to investigation, the preliminary investigation before it goes for a final investigation. That committee help us also to ascertain if what we term as fraudulent is fraudulent. Chair, the next slide on slide 18. Myself and Vuyo, we are on the same page. We've also brought in the same team, FTMG, who are helping us with our investment, the graph standard in interpretation, and also ensuring that our financials are clean of material misstatements and are complete and correct. I think the one area that I want to lift up here, Chair, is we have about 14 chartered accountants. In that space, we have about three low-level accountants that are on their way to become chartered accountants and five graduates that they are using. Now, all of these people have been assigned to an individual in our working environment for transfer of skills. So as they are doing their work, they are working directly with one of our officials, be it a director or a deputy director, but they work closely every day to make sure that as they're doing the work, there's skills transfer, there's documentation, and there's processes that are documented so that when they leave, we have documented process that has been tested and are used for our audit processes. Chair, I'm going to move now to fraud and corruption cases. This is now slide 20. Chair, in slide 20, slide 21, slide 22. I think, Chair, what I'm listing in these three slides are all the irregular, fruitless, and wasteful expenditure cases. And here, Chair, I'm confirming that these cases have been finalized. The only cases that are outstanding, there's only two cases out of the 16. Only two cases have not been finalized due to outstanding documentation, but it's a process that is happening now. And I'm anticipating that these two cases should be finalized by end of September. I'll talk on the next steps on these cases in the area around consequence management. The next slide, on slide 23, Chair, what I'm lifting up here are the cases that have been assigned to SIU. If you recall, the president issued a proclamation on COVID test payments, and among the emphasis for phase one was all the payments that were made to government officials, NAFSAs, prisoners, and the deceased. And to date, Chair, SIU has been able to secure 42 million rands in terms of acknowledgement of debt, and 33 million rands of this amount has been paid back to SIU, and that's the money that we'll be recouping moving forward. On slide 24, again, Chair, I'm continuing on the COVID CARES cases. As of 23 August, Chair, we had about 230 million rands that the asset forfeiture unit had, the amount that was exposed to potential fraud. Of this amount, the asset forfeiture unit was able to preserve 133, and 123 rands of this, of 133 has already been paid back to UIF. The difference between 230 and 133 is those cases that are before court, where people have been convicted and people have also acknowledgement of debt and are making arrangements to pay back the money. And just on the same slide, Chair, we have five convictions to date. We have last year we had five convictions again, and there were two acquittal cases. If you look at slide 25, Chair, and I think I've got the slide 26, slide 27. So what we are lifting up in these three slides is, one, these are cases that has been before court. They've been finalized. There's 11 cases in total. I've added case numbers there. I've added the province, how many people are involved, the date the case was finalized, and what was the nature of the case. And also how many years of imprisonment has been issued. I think the one case, Chair, that was issued about 2 weeks ago is the one where someone was found guilty, or Mr. Kumete, and sentenced to 135 years in prison with only 20 years, if 20 years direct imprisonment that this person will serve. But these are the cases, Chair, that has been concluded in court and convictions have been issued. And then on slide 28, Chair, these are the cases, slide 28 and slide 29. These are the cases that are before court. There's case, and once again, Chair, you have case numbers, you have the province, you have the estimated amount, exposure, and the number of people that are accused, and also the number of companies that are accused there, Chair. These 10 cases are before court. Some of them are close to conclusion. Some of them, we have people that have pleaded guilty to the cases, but they are just awaiting sentences. Chair, the next slide, from slide 30, maybe we just go straight to slide 31. I think, Chair, one of the areas that was lifted in the previous appearance before SCOPA was our old legacy system, and I can confirm, Chair, that we have a sub-dependable project. Now, the purpose of this project is to have an integrated enterprise solution which will give us a single view of our data and our clients, and also the services provided by the department. And the sub-project cuts across both compensation fund and the whole department. This will enable us to migrate from our current legacy system to a sub-ERP project. Even the Dimafata, you can go to the next slide. Slide 32. Chair, on this slide, and members, what I want to lift up is the status of some of the projects. As you can see, we're anticipating to deploy around end of March 2023, which is next year. And you have different percentages, the status of where we are now with each of the deliverables for the projects, with the highest sitting at 85%. But our target is by next year, March 2023, we are deploying and we'll have a new technology online. So it's a few months away, we'll be using a new technology. And then on slide 33, Chair, what I'm lifting up here, slide 33 and slide, maybe you can go to slide 34 in the Dimafata. On slide 34, Chair, what I'm highlighting here is the current solution that we're using at URF. We've integrated the operation system and the online platform so that there's a seamless processing of claims. Whilst we are moving towards having SEP on board, we are making sure that the current technology that we have at least also provides a seamless services to our customers. And Dr. Mafati, if you can go to slide 37, or maybe just go straight to slide 38. Okay, Chair, what we are lifting up here is that as a result of the SIU investigation, Chair, this is a confirmation of the consequence management that was meted out to officials, moving from a warning to a final written warning with 1 month salary suspension. But all of these cases, Chair, have been finalized, disciplinary process has taken place, and people are serving their term of the disciplinary process. And then on slide 39, these are just the two cases that are on the brink of being finalized. We have one senior manager where the case has been finalized, just waiting for the closing arguments. Anticipation is that by end of September, this should be finalized as we are waiting for these closing arguments and then mitigating, and then the chairperson issues the final verdict. Chair, on slide 40 and slide 41. Slide 40 and slide 41, these two slides, Chair, they are linked to the cases that has been finalized, as I mentioned earlier, in the investigation process, that there's 16 investigation cases that has been finalized. What I'm reflecting here is we've issued intent to discipline to the people that are implicated to all the cases that has been finalized. Is about 39 in total letters of intent that has been issued. And once we've received the response from the people that we've issued the intent to discipline, then the next steps would follow. And then on slide 42, I think there was a discussion previously, there was a discussion previously around the Accenture investigation, and Chair, I can indicate that there's two people who are not exonerated previously who are facing disciplinary. The presiding officer and prosecutor has been appointed, and the cases will start soon once the date has been confirmed. The other matter, Chair, that I want to lift up. Previously, the committee had requested that we seek a legal opinion with respect to naming and shaming of those companies that were found to have defrauded the COVID test. Advocate Mkonto will speak briefly, Chair, on the legal opinion. The legal opinion will be shared with the members after the meeting. Advocate Mkonto can just speak on the legal opinion briefly.
Good afternoon, good morning, Chair, and to members and the commissioners and colleagues. Yes, indeed, the legal opinion was sought by management last year, and to the extent that the legal opinion is having looked at our MOA, there's no basis at that we have covered to in the legal opinion in the MOA to name and shame those that would have defrauded. What we've catered for at the drafting at that stage was to follow the money which the commissioner had already reported on. In brief, that's what I can report on. Thank you very much.
All right. Are you fine?
Oh, thank you, Chair. I was just saying that's the end of our presentation. Thanks, Chair.
Okay. All right. Colleagues, over to you. Thank you very much, UIF. Honorable Somio.
Thank you very much, Chair. Going back to slide 38. Slide 38, please.
Can we put the presentation back up and go to slide 38 that Honorable Somya is referring to?
Yes. Slide 38 refers to the DC in relation to those who are in the supply chain, as recommended by the SIU. And if you look into what has been the outcome, the outcome borders on warning. And then my question is that, are these individuals still involved with the supply chain management unit? The first question. If they are still involved, what sort of control mechanisms that are in place to stop the recurrence of what we have seen in terms of these disciplinary processes? Thirdly, don't you think that it's a bit funny though, looking into the uniform outcomes in as far as the finalization of the DCs, for me, they bring something a bit odd. What sort of a standard mechanism which would be affirmed to ensure the quality presentation of your disciplinary processes, giving rise into valuable outcomes? Thank you very much, Chair.
Right, thank you very much, Honorable Lee, Honorable Mkond, Honorable Mkalipi, in that order, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you to UIF. Okay, the questions are going to be quite similar, I suppose, to Compensation Commission, except that when we visited the UIF office a couple of years ago, now seems like yesterday, there was a massive email and call center backlog. Can we have an update of where we stand there with numbers coming in, numbers able to be dealt with, and what the backlog is today? And then the question of the unlisted investments, I think it applies probably more so to UIF than Compensation Commission. I think the investments are probably more, but I won't preempt an answer. So if we can have a value, current value of unlisted investments, and I hope, like with the Compensation Commission, you have a detailed report of these investments, which can be submitted to us in the next week or so, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that. So just the current value, similar to what Compensation Commission told us. And then my last question, Mr. Chairman, is one that I'm being faced with in my constituency a great deal, is in terms of timing it takes. You know, we're in an era of huge unemployment, and people need to access the UIF to survive. So from the time an application is made at one of the local Labor Department offices to the time it's approved, what is the kind of time limit there? What can our people expect? 24 hours, 24 days, 24 months until approval? and do they get notified of the approval? And then once approved, what is the time span until money hits their bank accounts? Again, is it hours, days, months? What is it? So, Mr. Chairman, those are my three, four UIFs this morning. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Honourable Liz. Honourable Nkonto.
Thank you, Chair. Welcome the presentation from Mr. Marupin. I'm advantaged, even though he did not introduce himself, but because he's my colleague, I know who he is. That was on a lighter note, Chair. Chair, my first question will be the vulnerable sectors, Chair, in the list on slide 24. I did not see the Buddha race because we have been doing oversight in the farms, and it was confirmed more than once that the farming sector has been defrauding the UIF in as far as TERS is concerned. But on the list, I did not see even a single one. Maybe we can be clarified in as far as that is concerned. And then there is a slide that talks about the technology that will make the claims to be a seamless service. Chair, the accessibility in as far as the vulnerable, the workers in the rural areas and in the farming sector, how accessible and how user friendly and cost effective will that technology be? And the last question, Chair, will be the outcome of the outcomes of the disciplinary processes and the SIU, the cases referred to the SIU, their outcomes, to me, they are not correlating. If companies have been found to have done wrong and money is being demanded back, and then who did the administration part? If according to the disciplinary cases, people are just getting warnings, and then who did it? Because it has to me, it has to balance. If the SIU has found a certain company guilty, surely there is someone in the department that has engaged on the administration of that particular claim. And then are we having those as part of those that are convicted successfully? That is what I want to know, Chair. Thanks very much.
Honorable Mkalipi.
Thank you very much, Chairman. The UIF is a very important part of our lives because the unemployment in South Africa is quite high. Now, I'll seem as if I'm repeating what I've raised when we were dealing with the compensation fund presentation. There is a problem in the UIF, Commissioner Teboho. If you can check your WhatsApp that I just WhatsApp you now, because the number, I just got it yesterday from the DG, is the case whereby a complainant or a claimer or a person who wants to claim his or her UIF applied on February this year. It's February, no payment from UIF. And we are talking about people who are unemployed. Who is relying on this money? That is one point. Second, it seems as if everything, especially the UIF, there's no appetite from your department to address it. Because we advise people to go to local centers of labor centers to go and apply. But the amount of queues, I think, Chair, we have raised this concern here when they were here in front of SCOPA, because we do attend this meeting to also represent people. The queues there in the labor centers is also disadvantaging people. As a result, those who are responsible for those labor centers, they ended up not knowing how to control those queues because people ended up going back home without being assisted. That is one. Secondly, your system is forever down when people, they want to apply for their UIF money. Remember, this UIF is an intervention to their life because they are unemployed. As I'm making a case of the 17th February, the case that I just forwarded to you, and I've been trying to send it to Advocate Yawa from the department. As a result, I said, DG, can you intervene? We are talking about hungry people here. So that is the main concern. The second concern is that now we have to get your proper guidance here as a department on how to deal with these cases. For instance, the new cases of fraud that you are also talking about in your slides here. You are saying that there are new cases that are surfacing from the departments, from the provinces. But let me tell you, I have engaged, let me tell you, on the 15th of July, I went and sit down with Mr. Kambule and raised some of the issues pertaining to the department in KZN. 15th July, today is 7th September, or it's 5th September, I can't remember the date exactly, Chair, but I'm saying my point is, there is no appetite from the department to address issues pertaining UIF and also this terror thing. Because we are saying to us here, there are new cases that are surfacing of which you are attending to it as a department. But now a person is reporting a case of TERS, a certain company claimed, and them as workers, they didn't receive it. And then they report it to the department to say, come and investigate. And while they are still employees of that certain employer, the minute your department is attending to that case, that employer just fired that person. And that person must go to System A to lodge a complaint of unfair dismissal. Then, after that is history. That person have lost the job and have not received his or her money that was claimed on his behalf. If you can update us on that aspect as well, as Honorable Riz was saying, that the last time we were there, also your call center, there was no capacity in your call center. But now I just want to get a clarity. How, as a department currently, are you dealing to address that situation? Can't be a person that apply in February, hungry as he is, and up until now, there is no response from the department. And I'm talking about this issue is not one case. It's many cases that we are facing on daily basis. How do you deal with the situation of long queues, a down system, and the issue of capacity that you don't have as a department? Because it's frustrating. It's frustrating poor people who are unemployed and who does not have any hope of getting an employment so soon. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, colleagues. Let's get responses to that and we'll do follow-ups afterwards. We're still good on time. UIF, over to you.
Thank you, Chair. Let me start with the issues raised on slide 38. I think that the challenge with the final outcomes of the hearing is dependent on what the chairperson receives, who's presiding. Oftentimes, always, we appoint an independent presiding officer who preside over a case. Sometimes it's someone from another department who comes and preside over a case. And we also bring in a prosecutor from a different environment, so we don't bring someone from inside. Now, they make a call depending on what is presented before them and the facts before them. And Chair, I think that's all I can say with respect to the final outcome of a disciplinary hearing. And just to clarify, Chair, we have three final written warnings. A final written warning is an alternate to dismissal, because it lasts for 6 months. If you do anything within that period, then you get dismissed. And we have one person who received a final written warning with a month's salary suspended. So, but these are the findings, Chair, of an independent presiding officer. Now, with respect to whether these people are they still involved Are they still involved in some of the processes? Church, when SIU investigated this process, it investigated from the PEC, the bid evaluation committee, the bid specification committee, the bid adjudication committee. So these were independent staff members who have their own independent functions in separate areas, but they had formed part of a committee that appointed a particular service provider. So they've gone back to their own roles. We've also trained all the UIF staff members about SCM processes. We are also doing a controls self-assessment as part of the control environment review. We've brought in internal audits to review our control environment. And also FKMG is helping us to review the entire control environment just to make sure that our supply chain are above board. As part of the process, Chair, we've introduced Probit. I think it was in 2020 towards May. In June, we introduced Probit. The Probit function, what their role is to test every supply chain process before any appointment is done. That's the role of Probit. And it helps us to make sure that the supply chain processes are closed and there's no gaps in our supply chain process. With respect to an issue of massive email backlog, Chair, this was cleared already in December 2021. All the backlogs on the emails were cleared and we attended to. Now, there's an issue raised about what is the value of our unlisted portfolio. Our unlisted portfolio in total is 20.6 billion rands for UIF, Chair. And it has about 20 investee company in total. Just over 25 investee companies in the unlisted space. Now, the issue with how long it takes to pay claims, there's one big problem that UIF often face. On one hand, we have to deal with fraud. On the other hand, we deal with employers that are not declaring their employees. They don't pay their contributions. And if they do pay, declare their employees, they jump. Now you find that when an employee comes to apply, there's missing months in their declaration. And what is key, Chair, that I need members to understand, when you process claims, your declarations are important because in your declarations, we have your salary amount for that period and you use the salary to process your claim. And we start the salary amount and the number of days that you've worked for a particular period. We could easily pay you small amounts when you possibly deserve more. And that's why these claims, we don't process them unless we've received all the necessary information, which is declarations, contributions, and we've also closed the gaps. That might be there in your declaration as an employee so that you receive the requisite amount. Now, what you oftentimes do, I think the same issue was raised within the team of fight, is around the inspections. As UIF also, we employed our own employer auditors just to supplement the departmental inspectors. So we have our own UIF employer auditors who would go to these companies to inspect, especially where there's a claim and they visit the companies and clear the declarations, clear the contributions, and close the gaps on the declarations to make sure that when we pay the claim to the individuals, they receive what is due to them. Now, with respect to funding sector, I'm with the CRO here, and he was saying to me, he hasn't received any fraud cases reported for the funding sector. It doesn't mean it's not happening, Chair. It just means we have not received any cases reported to us about fraud happening in the farming sector. And Chair, we are willing and available to receive those cases so that we can send the investigators. And the good thing with COVID tests is we are working with the Fusion Center, that which includes the Hawks. It includes the Hawks, SIU, Asset Professional Unit, and they help us, an NPA who helps us to speed up the investigation. Because COVID tests the priority. So as soon as we receive the cases, they get attended as quickly as possible. Chair, the issue around accessibility and whether the introduction of the new technology will serve people in the rural of the rural, I think, Chair, we take that concern. Yes, there's logic to that concern, Chair, that we may introduce technology, it might not serve everyone in the country. People in the farms, rurals, and some of the townships may not have access to technology. To that end, Chair, we've introduced the URF passes. These URF passes are used to go to the rural of the rural to go and visit. We've also introduced a USSD. The USSD is used, these phones of 100, the small phones, 100 rand, where people are able to process the URF claim without data, without the cost implications for data on their part. So they can use the USSD and don't have to incur the cost of data. So we have that also coming up in the next 2 months. We are also going to be introducing the app, because the intention of introducing the app and on the online platform is to reduce the number of people that visit our labor centers and only limit it to the people who don't have access to these technologies, or they might not have access to a USSD. And that's the plan. The issue of claims, as I've explained, questions raised by Honorable Mkhalifi, the claims of the 17th of Feb. I'm going to investigate the case that she sent to me. Some of the experiences that South Africans go through are unacceptable, Chair. I cannot justify and say there's a justification behind it. I'm going to investigate the case to find out what really transpired, who was at fault, and identify where the bottlenecks was, and then take the necessary steps once I've gone through the case. With respect to the queues being long in the labor centers, we've introduced queue marshals across all the provinces with the intention of reducing the queues but also in particular that the queue marshals can go and speak to the people in the queues and attend to the issues whilst they are there. Because sometimes you find the person is on the queue for 3 hours only to be told once they get to the front of the queue that they need to go and complete a bank form when they could have been told earlier in the process. And that's why we are introducing these queue marshals so that they can address those items. The issue of the systems down chair, this is something that we are attending to as a department. We are moving now to cloud. We've also moved our data center to Midrand. I think that the biggest problem that the DG did mention previously was the issue of our marriage with CETA and reliance on using the CETA technology, the CETA environment. That is not particularly reliable. And as a result, we have these downtimes oftentimes coming through. And the Minister and the DG are working on a project to see if there's an alternative to the system downtime, because it's dependent on the network that we're getting via the CETA space. So that's something we're looking into. With respect to the call center, Chair, we've now outsourced our call center to an extent that we've employed over 350 call center agents compared to the initial 50 agents that we used here at UIF. Now there's 350 call center agents that have been employed that are dealing with call center issues. I think there may be glitches as they're taking over and running through the processes, but we anticipate that things will start to cool down as they get acclimatized to the environment. Chair, I hope I didn't miss any questions. I believe I've covered all the questions, Chair.
All right, colleagues, are you honorable Liz?
Sorry, Chair.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Honorable Swamio will come in, I'm sure. I just want some clarity, please. In terms of the unlisted investments, will we get that full report? I didn't hear a commitment to give us the full report. And then I didn't really, I mean, we heard a lot of reasons why it's slow for applicants to finally receive the benefits. But you know, if everything is in place and all the right documentation is presented on application, how long should it take if there are no complications? That's really, I mean, I understand that there could be all sorts of complications, but assuming there are none, how long should it take? Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Honorable Somya.
No, thank you very much, Chair. I think thanks for the answers. There's only one area which I think hasn't been answered sufficiently. Because my point is within the understanding that the framework on supply chain requires a number of platforms and players. And therefore the individuals who have been enlisted, who have run through the process of DC and had their verdicts based on such, are they still taking part on procurement processes? Are they still involved? If I go to the register of any committees, I would find their names there after that period, inclusive of what you have referred to in terms of the control environment, which relate to witnesses on your supply chain controls. That's what I was trying to get from you, Mshabaz. Just some kind of indication on that area. Thank you very much, Chair.
Welcome. Thanks, Honorable Somi. Can that slide actually be put back? The one of those those written warnings.
At 38, yeah.
Because I'm also there, Bab Somi, I want to get right. Now, maybe I think the issue is, can we be taken through the offenses here? Like in some form of abbreviated what's the word? Summary of sorts. Because I just find this thing of written warnings to be one of the, to put it crudely, to be one of the biggest jokes that exists insofar as consequence management is concerned. But I'll give the benefit of doubt that due process was done. So can, because I think it's just fundamental to the issue. The offenses, one written warning was issued on the 29th to a deputy director for what? And so on. Because the issues the issues that you have are just grave. They are huge. They are massive. And written warnings, so UIF, over to you. Honor Mkhalipi, is that a historic hand or is it a new hand?
It's a new hand, Chair.
Oh, okay, that's fine. You may proceed and then we'll get responses.
Yeah, no, I think, Chair, you are quite correct. Commissioner Teboho, I also ask about the appetite and capacity of the provinces, since you also, on your presentation, spoke about new cases that are resurfacing of fraud from TERS. So I couldn't get a response there. And I demonstrated to you that I engage with your people on provinces. And I even said to you, the last time I met with your provincial manager, I don't know what is a good title, Bob Kambule, and raised issues. Up even today, I have not get those responses, including the fraud case of TERS. So I'm saying to you, can you also update the committee in terms of the fraud cases? Because those are the serious matters. And our people are faced with unfair dismissal if they keep on reporting about those cases, which is their money, by the way, that those companies have frauded them. That is one. The second one, which I didn't ask, Chair, maybe let me use this opportunity. There was floods in KZN and companies were closed down and the employees also suffered because of floods. So can you also update this committee if there are companies who also applied for temporary relief schemes on behalf of workers, and if they didn't pay workers. And secondly, if companies applied and managed to pay workers because of floods, how does it work? Does the UIF get affected or is another scheme that seeks to intervene when there is a disaster in the country? Thank you very much, Chair.
Yeah, all right, maybe. And finally, UIF, why haven't you submitted your 2021? Let's get responses to all those. I mean, because right now we are busy with the audit processes of 21-22, but we have not seen you 2020-21. So you are behind. So let's get responses to all those issues.
Thank you, Chair and members. Let me start with whether we'll receive a full report on unlisted. Yes, Chair, we'll make the report available for unlisted to the members. It takes 15 days to process ordinary benefits, which is your unemployment benefit, if everything that you require is in place. And then for a death benefit, it takes about 20 days. Now, with respect to whether the people are still serving in these committees, Chair, where they were disciplined for, I did an overhaul of the BEAT evaluation and the PAC committee. So it's a new committee that sits. But the PAC has been overhauled. The PEC is specific to what you procure at that point in time. And each time it's appointed for the new product that has been procured. But I just need us to be careful, Chair, that once a person has served their sentence, we cannot keep them in abeyance forever. I think there comes a point when their function ends. But these committees have been overhauled, Chair, all of them. All the committees have been overhauled. It's new committees that are serving there. Appetite to address issues. Chair, we do have an appetite to address these issues. I'll take it up with the provincial chief inspector, Ubabu Kambule, KZN, to find out what really happened with this case. But the CRO has just advised me now. And I'm not too sure if this is the same issue. We have four cases, that has been reported in KZN, fraud cases that has been opened for KZN. And I'll just need to check Ubabu Kambule. It's on slide 28 and slide 29. Devon Central, and also Devon Central. So there's four cases reported for KZN. So I'm not too sure if it is the case that Honorable Mkalipi is relating to, or is a different one. Now, with respect to the flood in KZN, Chair, we didn't introduce a new scheme to provide relief to those companies, employees affected. But we had already have a benefit in existence, what that we call short-term employment. Because during the flood period, the companies shut down for a period. And for that period, we have a benefit called short-term. There were companies that applied on behalf of their employees. And the process that we follow is when a company applies, they apply for the employees, but money is paid directly to the employees. Is not paid to the employer, it just goes straight to the employees. So if there's a need for us to bring a report on how many companies applied for the flood in KZN and how many employees and how much was paid, I can bring that in the next engagement, Chair. And then, Chair, with respect to us not submitting financials, the main issue here that we are facing is similar to what Ndati Mafata mentioned earlier, is his issues around investment. The critical issue with the investment portfolio, especially the 20.6 billion rand, which is almost 25% of our portfolio, is that it's significant. And oftentimes, the companies that we invested in have financial year end that differs from ours. There are companies whose financial year end is August, it's September, some of them is May, so it's different financial year end that affects us accounting fully at the time that other institutions in government will be able to report. The other issue is the COVID test process, Chair. As part of the financial reporting, as UIF, we needed to report for the 61 billion that we paid to these companies. And part of the accounting is us being able to show that the 61 billion rands was paid to the rightful people. And that's part of the follow the money project that we're busy with. As I said earlier, we've been able to cover 18 billion rands, and we're busy now with the auditors to cover the remaining 40 odd billion rands. We're also engaging the banks to see if we cannot run that quickly, such that we're able to account fully for the 61 billion rands. There's work that has been done by the SIU, Asset Forfeiture Units, the HOGS, and then the NPA. And they've recovered a lot of money on behalf of URF. And the money still sits with these different entities. And it needs to be accounted for in our financials. It needs to come into the URF pot. And that's a process that we're still busy with, because investigations are still happening. Arrests are still happening. Court proceedings are still happening. So the process is still ongoing. And it makes it almost impossible for us to give a proper financial position of the fund. Thank you, Chair.
Right, colleagues, are you fine with that?
Fine, Chair. Samuel, this is, I'm fine. Though I want to address his rider in dealing with the question, because you see, the cardinal point on consequence management is a bit attitudinal, and in that instance, it does not necessarily carry that if any infringement has been dealt with through a particular process up to its own logical conclusion, and therefore the matters of trust have been restored. Once you deal with matters of decision making, most of which are of value financial, you need to assure and guarantee that individuals involved would uphold the maximal ethical conduct. And one of the measures is followed through existing records. And such records would tell anyone who is involved in matters that require execution and to account for such. Would be that there would be no matters of fairness rather than getting into yourself as an accounting officer at a particular point, that your laxity in dealing with such matters and your judgment in upholding such matters that relate to ethical related matters would have to have an outlook of passing the master at all times. So the questions that relate to your teams in decision making, in as far as procurement is concerned, if they would carry certain names which have been judged on those matters, for me that would count on you. You don't necessarily, in honouring matters of consequences, you'd continue having such individuals in the same decision-making frame, and that should not be taken lightly. It should not be a rider they've finished their sentence, and therefore they are right. That's why the record would have to be kept, even if that they have run through the process 6 months. So that's why Honorable Shlengwa and myself are querying what we are seeing there, the warnings, whether is it written, whether is it not written, you see, because that is malicious compliance in as far as such matters are concerned. And don't bring us to that kind of an assessment. It gets into value of a substantive nature, which would have to rely on your ability as an accounting officer of an institution to delve on such. It is coupled with the fact that you have received a legal opinion on whether those entities which have dealt a blow in terms of your actual claims to be somewhat enlisted as have done this and that. What else, because you have heard us, what else can you do to ensure that those who are doing business with yourself who have been found wanting on those matters are kept out of the practice lying with your own intention to decide on these matters? Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, Wobson, you were right. I might have missed it. I don't know. Maybe I had a technical glitch and I missed it. I just wanted to go back to this slide because for me, it's the microcosm of our challenges. So again, can we go through these cases? What was the charge? What was the offense? And why haven't you submitted? Why is it so difficult to answer those issues? But if I've missed it, then I apologize. These, it's not many. 2, 4, 6, 7, 8. What were the charges here? Because this thing really of written warning, the ones that say one final written warning, after how many? Have there been others before, and what was the charge there? This thing of not wanting to go to the substantive details and give us these tip of the iceberg kind of cosmetic presentations just doesn't fly. Because we need to know fundamentally, what are people doing wrong? So, the cases and why you haven't submitted. I'm just building on Honorable Somyo is saying. Because you've got this under SIU cases, the headline there. That's very serious. It's not, you are not citing these as internal. These are SIU cases. So already there's a red flag for me. An SIU case and the conclusion is a written warning? No, no, no. So let's go through that seriatim one by one on those ones.
Chair, I didn't bring the details, but I can avail the SIU report to the members.
No. It can't be. This is something you should have. This is your presentation. You would have to have derived it from somewhere. And I suspect by the imagery behind you in the office. So it's something that's close by. Please don't, let's not lalu makashelana. Let's not do a Tom and Jerry. Let's not do a Tom and Jerry here. These are issues that really should be at your fingertips. Because I think you have worked with us quite at length to know that we want substantive details on issues. You know that. So let's not play with Tom and Jerry, please.
Chair, I'm getting ER. Because I don't want to give you a global view and you will not be satisfied with that either.
Yeah, I think you can be speaking to the other issues whilst you get that information and assure you that our application for this meeting goes to 1:30. And so that's 1 hour and 20 minutes and I can assure you we don't mind waiting.
Chair, I think with respect to the SCM people, as I said earlier, Chair, all the committees have been revamped and overhauled. We have a new bid adjudication committee. We have PECs appointed as and when a specific item is required, and the same applies to the bid specification committee. They're appointed as and when they're required. Whilst I'm waiting for the person from ER, Chair, and also I must indicate that I was part of the people who were disciplined here, Chairperson. I'm the one who received the final written warning and a 1 month salary suspension. And I think, Chair, that's what makes it a bit difficult for us to discuss this area. These were disciplinary hearing methods to from the commissioner to the CFO, all the members of the executive. And I think, Chair, if you would allow, I'd rather you let the DG speak to this matter.
Before he does, Honorable Liz.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick one. I'm sorry to take you back a little bit, but the Compensation Commission indicated it had slowed down or put more stringent parameters in place to reduce unlisted investment losses. Can the UIF tell us what they have done and whether the similar measures have been taken? Thank you.
What responses to that? Let's go to the responses that are outstanding.
Chair, if I may, while the commissioner is trying to get ER or the DG to respond. Good morning, honorable members. My name is Fezeka Puzi. I'm the CFO at the fund. Chair, I would like to respond to the question on the unlisted investments. Yes, what I can indicate is that, yes, we have put a hold on further investment in unlisted investments. The fund took a decision to invest, I think it was 20% of its total portfolio to the unlisted investments. As the commissioner had indicated, that 20.6 billion was investigated in these unlisted investments. And due to the poor performance of some of these instruments and some of these instruments being impaired to an extent that the fund sometimes gets to lose money, some of these instruments have been are under liquidation. So the fund took a decision to say we are not going to invest further in these unlisted investments. We are going to put a hold on those and then only service the ones that are currently performing. So that's the decision that we've taken. However, we are also looking at the strategy of exiting these instruments. However, we don't want to lose at the end of the day. So we are very, calculating in terms of, looking at this and this instruments chain. What has happened, we've also instructed the PIC to, manage these instruments actively. For instance, they have since now opened or established a unit that would look at turning around these companies that are in distress. So on a monthly basis, they then report to us. And what has been requested to them is for them then to look at these companies that are under distress and come up with recommendations. For instance, if a company cannot be assisted, further, then they need to then indicate to the fund so that we can take a decision to exit that instrument or that investment. So that's where we are, Chair, and there are no further investment in the unlisted investments given the challenges that we're currently facing. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, CFO. I see my our slide of focus has gone.
Chair, I don't mind. I don't mind. Why can't we ask that they forward the detail of what we require from
from such. And my interest, with the interest of VEDO for consequence management, is on the, even if you have revamped those kinds of committees and other people will come in as things would come on their way. You see, we don't have to take these things lightly. You see, what your response takes this a bit lightly, as I somewhat would make my own assessment. If ever you would somewhat expose to us that in writing, in both instances, on what the Honorable Chair has dealt with in terms of that detail that we want, and secondly, on the areas that relate to such committees, even the calls on time to time, because we really don't want anyone who would represent his or her section who is still having the same kind of plight in terms of the mist around him or her or on those areas. I don't know the chair would probably address our interests around this matter, that we allow them to go back, detail all those areas that we have asked them, and within 7 days we get that kind of a correspondence on those matters. That's my plea. I'm looking into time in any event.
No, fair enough, Babsomo, I hear you. But you know, in my reflections just over the past few days, there is this tendency of an easy way out to escape public scrutiny and public accountability with written submissions, because the obvious reality is that we get them as a record, and maybe we have not taken a decision that we take the public into confidence, because the issue here is the UIF specifically is a public good which the majority of our people are dependent on, particularly during this time of economic downturn. And a veil of secrecy or a arrangement, it was just an arrangement outside the public. So that's a reality I was reflecting on in the past few days, on these submissions that are made, particularly on basic things which really don't need to we go back on. But I still maintain that it's cases that are there, and they're easy to put out to us. And why haven't they submitted their 2020-21? This veil of But let's hand over to UIF. UIF?
How is Corner Chair?
Chairperson.
As we are going to submit that report, I just want to indicate that all the officials with the SIU cases, it was due to contravention of SCM processes, in particular the interpretation of sole source against emergency. We had procured a media company using sole source during an emergency, and the interpretation was we didn't interpret the sole source correctly. That was the basis of the investigation. But I think then the full report of SIU will indicate where they believe we got this wrong and why they believe it was wrong.
Why haven't you submitted 2020-2021?
2020-2021. Yes, our records indicate that you have not submitted your annual report to Parliament.
Oh, the AG finished in March and the final sign off of the annual report was finalized last week. We are going for print this week. So by next week, we'll have the report sent through to the Parliament.
When next week?
Next week, Friday.
Yeah, so tell us what you're going to do. I think the fundamental issue here, the absence of the minister does pose a problem. Circumstances he has explained notwithstanding. I don't get a sense of a seriousness on the part of the EUIF, but I'm not surprised at all. So it's perfectly fine. We will see how far they are prepared to go with this Tom and Jerry kind of outlook. And maybe what we should do is to get the SIU to come and brief us on these cases of the UIF, because we are saddled with the situation of people who are players and referees in matters of consequence management affecting them. And hence this kind of dilly-dallying and what I can only term a blatant refusal or a Stalingrad being put in place to respond to issues which are basic. So it's fine. Yeah, it's okay if that's how they want to conduct themselves on even the most basic issues of oversight and accountability. So I think we'll find another date, get the SIU in, and then that annual report will arrive next week, Friday, when we'll have a look at it. But because it's done, I think then you must know what audit outcome are we dealing with now in 2020, 2021?
It's a qualification, sir.
Okay, that's fine. We'll have a look at all those areas that are qualified as well. And then we'll schedule a hearing on that outside the scope of the matters of today. Because this umjigacho that is being played here, or revolving doors, is a nowhere. It's actually, I think, a waste of our time and a waste of your time. So let's get that annual report to come in, and anything else that requires written submissions, as Babu Somi has suggested, is 7 days. So we can get that next week, Wednesday, by close of business, and get your annual report to reach us by next week, Friday, as you have said. And then we will couple it with a meeting with the SIU to actually brief us on its cases. So, colleagues, I'm not sure if there's any other matter that you'd like to raise on your part.
All good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. All right. No, it's all good, colleagues. We understand that in any case, we have not arrived here easily, so it's fine. So Stombi, tomorrow are we doing RAF?
Yes, Chairperson.
All right, colleagues, tomorrow RAF, 9:30. Let me take this opportunity to thank the UIF and to thank the Compensation Fund for appearing before us this morning, and we will take up the matters as we have outlined, and we will still come back to this outer date, the Compensation Fund of March 2023, because I think it in itself is problematic and is an open-ended something without targeted milestones or interim or short-term and long-term objectives which will give us the kind of comfort that something is taking place. So in itself is a problem. So we will come back to that as well, and probably look at monthly reports that they will submit, and probably colleagues schedule another meeting with the Compensation Fund and UIF
before maybe in the next term of Parliament, before Parliament rises again, so that we can get an update report. Because ultimately, unless the people at the UIF and Compensation Fund have got a keen appreciation of the gravity of the situation insofar as the adverse impact their institution has on the majority of our people who are dependent on them, then things are not going to change. Because ultimately, it's the ordinary man in the street who has to bear the brutal brunt of the kind of incompetencies, challenges, dilemmas, and shortcomings, and systemic problems which characterize the UIF and Compensation Fund. It's not people in boardrooms. They are continuing on a trajectory of a lavish lifestyle whilst the majority of our people suffer. And the perennial headache of the Compensation Fund and the UIF has been with us for the longest of time. And that is why I've always asked the question, why should these people who occupy positions continue in their positions in these institutions when substantively a majority of the problems we are dealing with have happened on their watch? It boggles the mind and doesn't make sense. And hence this kind of laissez-faire attitude, which has characterized the type of outlook we have had. So I hope that the UIF and the Compensation Fund understand the desperate circumstance which our people find themselves in at their hands. So colleagues, let's meet tomorrow at 9:30 with the Road Accident Fund, and we will take up these matters with the UIF and the Compensation Fund and the SIU and the AG before the end of this term or early next term, and find a mutual date with the minister as well. Colleagues, on that note, thank you very much, and the meeting stands adjourned.
All right, Chairman. Thank you, sir.